Welcome to Film Forum's podcast. The following event was recorded on November 28th, live at our theaters located at 209 West Houston Street in Manhattan.
Good evening. For all you aficionados, we want to have a couple of program notes. Tomorrow is the last day of our 3D auteur series, and we're showing two extremely rare films we think a lot of you will be interested in. One is Douglas Sirk's only 3D movie called Taza, Son of Cochise, starring Rock Hudson. It is the only 3D print in existence, and after we show it tomorrow, it will not be shown anywhere. We guarantee it. We're actually the only theater in New York that can do double system 3D. It will be introduced tomorrow at 6:30 by our host of tonight, Foster Hirsch, who's an expert on Douglas Sirk. And following that, we're going to be showing John Wayne in Hondo in 3D, which is one of the most extraordinary 3D movies of the early 50s. And it will be introduced by John Wayne's daughter-in-law, Gretchen, who runs John Wayne's Bat Jack Productions now. So now it's my great pleasure to welcome our dear friend, author of 17 and counting books on movies and theater. 15. Well, he's working on one on the films of the 50s, appropriately, Foster Hirsch.
Thank you. Thank you for coming out tonight to this very special event. When Diary of Anne Frank was released in 1959, it was unique. No American filmmaker, no American film studio wanted to make a film about the Holocaust at that time. The subject was considered too sensitive, too sacred, that somehow it was to profane it, to even represent it at all. And certainly no Jewish filmmaker or Jewish mogul at that time wanted this story to be told. It was a righteous Gentile named George Stevens who liberated one of the camps and took photographs of the liberation of a camp, and those photographs in color were used at the Nuremberg trials. It was George Stevens who had the courage to make this film, and it is a masterpiece. Out of 10,000 applicants, he chose the following woman to portray Anne Frank, and you will see tonight that he made the right choice. Please welcome my dear friend, the wonderful Millie Perkins. Millie, you're really part of history now. But in order to get the part of Anne Frank, Millie had to meet with Anne's father, Otto. Otto Frank had to agree that this woman could portray his daughter. Millie, can you take us to that meeting? Microphone.
Sorry. It's on. I had never acted before. I was living in New York City with my sister. They kept asking me to test for the film because George Stevens was looking for someone, and I was not an actress. He didn't want an actress. So
he wanted somebody people were not familiar with.
Right. So the thing is that I finally tested for the movie. Fun stories, but you don't want to wait for all those stories. But at any rate, when I went to California to test for it finally, Albert Hackett and Francis Goodrich, who wrote the screenplay for the movie, and they even wrote the play also, George Stevens asked me, he said, would you come to my house, come for dinner and meet Mr. Frank? And I said yes, and I was very shy. I was very unsophisticated, although I was not that young. I was 19 years old. I still was, compared to today's young people, I was unsophisticated. So the thing is that I went to dinner with Mr. Frank was there, and George Stevens and Albert Hackett and Francis Goodrich. And at one point, George Stevens, I just want to say something about George Stevens. I had never acted. I never wanted to act. I was not a great fan of movie stars. But one of my favorite books in high school was
American Tragedy,
which became the movie A Place in the Sun, and I had seen it in high school and had been my favorite book, and I thought, oh, someone said George Stevens directed that movie, and I thought, oh, well, then I will meet him. So I did meet him, and I tested in California and went to this dinner, and Mr. Stevens said, would you, Mr. Franck, go in the library and perhaps talk with each other? And I went in. I was terribly shy in those days. I mean, I didn't know what to ask, and I was kind of embarrassed. It was such a, it was a difficult situation for him and myself. But, you know, we sat there just kind of looking at each other, and at one point, finally, Mr. Franck looked down at my hands, and I was sitting there in the seat with both my hands like this, holding my thumb, you know, like this, kind of holding on, and he looked at it. it always moves me. He looked at it, and he got tears in his eyes. He was sitting there holding his hands the same way, and then he said, you know, Anna always sat there holding her hands like that. Mm. And it was just like, that was it. We didn't have to talk about anything else. It was like meant to be in some funny way. That's what it was. It was a lovely thing. And he was a lovely man. And I...
Would you have wanted him as your father?
Oh, he's my pal. Yes, I loved my father dearly. But if I ever... And when I met Mr. Franck, I thought if I ever had a father to choose from, it would be him. He was divine, and he loved his children. He taught them. He was an educator. He was a lovely, sensitive, gentle man. I knew I was in the right place when I met him, and he felt the same way about me, apparently. But the thing is, he did not come to the set when we shot the movie, and I never even knew if he had seen the movie. Because it was a sensitive thing, and he didn't come to the openings or anything like that. So finally, I gather, one day he did see the movie. But about two years ago, the Anne Frank House invited me to go for a festival they were having about the making of the diary. And when I got there, and all those years, I always wondered, I wonder if Mr. Franck saw the movie, and did he like me in the movie? Did he approve of the movie? And I never knew. And I went to the festival, and one of the girls that worked there came up to me and said, did you ever read the letter Mr. Franck sent you? I said, no, I never received a letter. Apparently, he had sent a letter to California after he had seen the movie in the early years, and no one ever sent it to me, and I don't know where it went. And she said, well, we have a copy of the letter because they had his archives, and it was the letter said. He loved me in the movie. He loved the movie. He was so proud that I played Anne Frank. And all those years, I didn't know. And 2 years later, I find out that he did. I mean, listen, I've done a lot of work. I played a lot of characters. I played a lot of mothers. Anne Frank was the only movie that ever really moved me. The rest was my job. And some I did very well, and some I didn't. But the Anne Frank, I had never read the diary of Anne Frank. I had never seen the Broadway play, and I was a model. I had just started modeling in New York, and I had no intentions of going anywhere but going to live in Paris for the rest of my life. And I got there, and the studio kept calling me to test me. They had seen my photos, and I kept saying, no, I'm not an actress, I'm sorry. But the French said, oh, Millie, you must go. It's a very important movie. Don't you understand? So I flew back to New York crying the whole way. And I thought, okay, I'll go test for this. And then I find out it was George Stevens, of course. Then I said, okay, I'll go to California. Except the man from MCA, when they want you to sign to test for a movie, they make you sign a contract first. So if you get the part, then you can't ask for more money because you've already made your deal. So I remember I got into the apartment in Greenwich Village where I lived, and he took me there about 7 in the morning, and he said, here's the contract. You have to sign the contract. I said, and I looked at the contract, and I said, well, I mean, I make more money as a model than this. They only wanted to pay me $150 a week to star in a movie. So I said, I'm sorry, I can't sign this contract. He said, they'll never give you any more money than that. And I said, well, then you'll have to tell them no. And I was dumb, but smart, or naive or something. And he called. He said, okay, I'll call them, but I'll call California now. But they're not going to give you the money. But you go out of the apartment. He made me leave the apartment, and I listened at the door while he called them to tell her. She's very poor. She supports her whole family. She has to have some more money.
Millie, when you got the part,
and they came
time,
back
I just
and gave me more money.
Lots of info. Lots to cover. So
okay,
listen to me.
Sure.
When you got the part, did you ever think, this is an enormous responsibility? I'm playing Anne Frank. And forever after, in the popular imagination, Anne Frank will be this woman. It doesn't matter if they're TV movies or stage plays. Anne Frank in George Stevens' film is the historical memory of Anne Frank, and it's this woman sitting next to me. Did you ever think that
No.
while you were making it? Would that have overwhelmed you?
No. I was an odd person, and I won't go into it. You can't have the time for it. But I had integrity, and when I did something, I did it as well as I could, whatever it was. It meant to me to do always a good job on something. When I flew from New York to California to test for the movie, I read the diary for the first time, and it hit me in the heart. That's all I can say. It hit me in the heart. I knew it was something. I knew what it, my father had been in World War II and World War I, and he was a Commodore 30 ships, and I knew all about the war and the atrocities and things that had happened, but I had never heard of Anne Frank. I knew when I read the diary that it was something. I didn't say to myself it was important. I just said it was hit me in the heart, and that was it. But during shooting, we did 6 months of shooting, and I had never met Hollywood. I'd never met movie stars, Shelley Winters. So, you know, and about 3 months filled with shooting, I remember, I was so tired. I thought, you know, I don't want to be an actress. And I went to George Stevens' office on the studio lot, and I knocked on his door, and she said, come in, Palsy. He was a lovely man. And he said, what can I do? And I started to cry, and I said, Mr. Stevens, I don't want to be an actress. If you mind if I go home? So it was after 6 months of shooting, mind you. He talked me out of it, and I went back to shooting. But over the years, I always knew that the Diary of Anne Frank was something bigger than life and phenomenal. And everything else was my job. I had children. I had a family. I paid the bills. But all my jobs were important to me, but nothing was the Diary of Anne Frank. It never will be.
Do you ever think these days, I know Millie very well, we're pals, mm-hmm. and I sometimes think when she says something a little off color, or this is Anne Frank speaking, do you ever think that you wouldn't say or do something because you played Anne Frank? Does she stay with you?
Yeah, always. I could tell scenes from the movie to you.
But her character, has she stayed with you?
When we were in Amsterdam, two very old people, older than me, I'm 80 years old, mind you, okay? So they came up to us and they said, you know, we were in school with Anne Frank, and she was a very difficult girl. She was a pain in the neck. She talked too much. She bothered the teacher. They had to send her home sometimes and call her parents and tell her to stop talking because she wanted everyone to hear everything she had to say. That was Anne Frank, and that's wonderful. The AFI did a special, something like the 100 most important moving films in the world or something, and Anne Frank was number 10, and they called me and asked me to come in and do an interview they were going to put on network TV about the making of Anne Frank and other movies, and they were lovely, they were so thrilled to have me, and except he said to me, he asked me lots of things, and I told him what Anne Frank about it, and then he said, well, what was Anne Frank like as a person? I said, well, she was very difficult. Her parents were always getting calls from the teachers to tell her that she must stop speaking out in class. She must stop interfering. She fought with her mother all the time. She was a difficult, very creative, hyperactive girl. And they said, well, really? He said, well, what would they say about, what would they do about Anne Frank today? And I said, well, they... I hope you don't mind my saying this. I said, well, they'd probably put her on Ritalin, and we never would have had the Diary of Anne Frank to keep her to tell her to shut up, you know, because that's the kind of person she was.
She was
a hyperactive girl.
High-strung. Very
intelligent.
High-strung.
And the only person she really got along with was her father.
And that comes through in the film. When we were, I had the privilege of being with Millie at the Anne Frank house, and these wonderful people who came up to us who were Anne Frank's colleagues, students, yeah. I said, did you know that you were going to school with a woman who was going to become the most famous Jewish woman in history? Mm-hmm. And they said, the charming little old man,
yes,
said, no, not at all. She was an average student. I got a better grade in German than she did. It made it so real.
Yes.
That made Anne Frank, yeah, was real. Now, Millie is a very good student of human behavior. She's very perceptive.
Mm.
So as we watch the film, I want you to say just a word or two about some of your co-players. The man who played your father, Joseph Schulkraut, was not very fatherly.
Well, let's put it this way. George Stevens was brilliant and a lovely man and a very brilliant director, and he knew, sorry, I hope you can hear me, he knew how to treat every actor the way they needed to be treated for him to get from them what he wanted as in the role. If he had yelled at me once, I would have gone home. I would not have allowed anyone to yell at me, and I would have gone home. Shelley Winters, Joseph Schulkraut and Shelley Winters, they stood out, and I loved Shelley, but she was very difficult, and she was the kind of person that we would be rehearsing the scene, and it would be great, and then Stevens would say to her, "Okay, everyone, go change your clothes, but Miss Winters, when you go to your dressing room, don't do what you usually do to come out and shoot the scene, because you're very different." Because Shelley always drank. When we did the Hanukkah scene, she got me in the room and she got me drunk. We had to close down for the day, you know. if we were shooting the scene and they were going to ask, he wanted me to go up to Shelley when we were talking about the fur coat, and I was supposed to say, "Oh, I love your fur coat," and she was supposed to listen to me. She would put her arm out so she could finish her lines before I got too close and push me in the chest, but the cameraman didn't know this, only the, and Joseph Shelley wanted the attention, and so did Joseph Schulkraut. Joseph Schulkraut, I was supposed to be listening to something my father was saying, and Mr. Stevens said, "Now stand up in the scene and listen to your father telling you this story during the Hanukkah scene," and it was a long speech that Joseph Schulkraut had, so what he did was he put his hand on my head and held it down so I couldn't come into the scene until he was finished with his lines. You know, it was very peculiar to me to meet people like that. I'd never met people like that, you know.
But he's wonderful in the part.
Oh, gosh, yes.
But it's acting, because he wasn't very fatherly.
And Shelley, I mean, I'd be doing a scene, and I can, as you can tell, I can cry at the top of a hat. I can cry at anything. And I would do a scene, and I'd say, But Mr. Van Damme, Peter didn't do that, and I'd get tears in my eyes or something, and Shelley would stand behind the camera when I was shooting a scene if I had to cry, and she'd go, and then he'd say, "Cut," and she'd say, "How did you do that? What made you cry? What was your mother like? What kind of a life did you have that you can cry like that?" I mean, you know, she was a character, and I appreciated it, but it was a pain in the neck. I remember halfway through shooting, we were at the beach, and I was with some movie stars on the beach in Malibu for the first time in my life, and some actor, I won't say who, came up to me and said, "Well, I mean, you've never acted before. I hear that you've been shooting this a long time. I guess Mr. Stevens has to work very hard and shoot a lot of takes with you." I said, and I was innocent, I said, "No, I said, I do it in one take, but Shelley Winters does about 30 takes." So,
well, George Stevens was famous for a lot of takes,
yeah,
but not with you.
No, because, look, he hired someone who was never an actress. If she couldn't do it right away, he wasn't going to take his time to teach me how to act. He had to know that I could do it, and I did it, and I'm proud of it. I never could say that for many, many years that I was proud of it, because I didn't know. I was busy living. But I'm proud of what I did, and I thank you.
You'll see, after we see this film, it's a long film and a very absorbing film. George Stevens didn't want to make it in CinemaScope, but it's absolutely perfect in CinemaScope. You get more of a sense of enclosure.
He didn't want to do CinemaScope.
He used to say,
"People look like fish when they're talking if we use CinemaScope." He wanted the old-fashioned way.
But it works in CinemaScope. It's so beautifully designed and so carefully directed. And you'll see at the end of the film why George Stevens chose this woman. If you haven't seen the film, you'll be reconfirmed. And Millie loves talking to people, in case you didn't get it. And after the film, after this long film, she wants to stay and take questions from the house.
If you want to stay that long, it's long. Thank you.
We will start. This is the roadshow print. Overture at the beginning.
5 minutes.
5 minutes of music at the beginning, and then there's an intermission, and then there's 4 minutes of exit music at the end. It's as if this is opening night at the Palace Theater, the original roadshow print.
Could I just say one other thing? The other actors, Lou Jacoby, who played Mr. Van Damme, he did it on stage. He was a lovely man. Gussie Huber was a lovely woman. And Ed Wynn, who played Mr. Gus Dussel, the dentist, When he walked on the set, it was sunshine walked on the set. It was the best thing. I had such a time never having seen actors in the movies and seeing all these different people with all their different personalities. It was new life for me. Yeah. Okay, good luck.
Thank you.
Okay, let's get started. It's late.
Stop being so modest. Is that a great film? Is that a great film? And isn't she wonderful?
It doesn't.
You can. Can you see why George Stevens chose her?
Oh, stop. Let's talk about the
movie. Absolutely. She's terribly modest.
Thank you. But doesn't it make you hear these things like, I still believe people are really good at heart and all these things that are going on? It's just worries you.
Every time she sees the film, you're in tears at the end, right? Every time.
Well, yes. And that always makes me cry. Yeah. I mean, it's endless. Yeah. Oh, I don't know. I'm sorry. Is there anything we'd like to
Any questions from the house?
Something?
Okay, wait for the microphone from Jeff over here.
Actually, just kind of, I lived in Amsterdam for 6 years, and I rode the canals every day. And it was so eerie just seeing nobody on the canals because you saw people every single day. I just can't tell how eerie it was to see nothing on the, no action whatsoever.
I know. I've been there a lot of times.
But they may not know that your film was shot entirely on a studio set at 20th Century Fox.
Yes, except the outside was done by George Stevens Jr., George Stevens' son, and he did the outside work, and he went over there. We didn't go until, I didn't get there until we went to, for the opening of the movie. It was quite amazing. This movie, it gets me every time. I mean, what can I say? I'm just moved, so I'm sorry I'm not so much fun anymore. So,
how long did you shoot?
We shot for 6 months, and it was I had never been to California. I was living in a one-room apartment. We started shooting. Every night I went home. I worked 5 days a week. I was exhausted on the weekends, and every night I would go and I'd make Morton's frozen macaroni for dinner. And that's what I had every night, and I was friends with Richard Beamer, who was my friend, who was a lovely, lovely young man, and everyone always thought we were probably in love or something, but we weren't. We used to make fun of everybody else. Diane Baker was my friend, and she still is. In fact, she called me last night. She's still around and doing, she's a beautiful, lovely woman. But Richard Beamer and I were pals, and we would make fun of everybody, make fun of Joseph Schildkraut, because every morning I'd come on the set, and everyone had a trailer on the studio stage, and we called him Peppy, and he was wonderful in the movie, but he was a card, you know. I would come in the morning, and he'd be waiting for me, and he'd be in his shorts, and he'd go, "Ooh, darling, ooh, oh, sorry," and he was always a corny kind of guy, but he cared, and he cared about the movie, and he was beautiful in it. And
was he jealous that there were a lot of scenes between you and Richard Beamer? Didn't he say at one point that this has become a young romance story?
Right. He at one point they'd go to the dailies at nighttime, and he would say, "This movie's becoming a film about boy meets girl in an Amsterdam attic, I think." You know, and Shelley was always striving to make sure she got her scene. I mean, you know, I tell you, she got me drunk. She cared, but she also cared about herself. But she got the Academy Award for the movie. Who could ask for more?
And her Oscar is at the Anne Frank House.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm. And she was wonderful. But for me, young, watching all these strange kind of people, it was quite an experience. And you know, Ed Wynn was an old, wonderful comedian. I don't know if you all know this, but he was wonderful. And Gusti Huber, she was a German.
Yeah, well, that's another story. You know, Gusti Huber, who plays the mother, was a member of the Nazi Party.
Wow.
And
there was a big...
Yeah, there
to
was
do
a big
about
scandal.
It when she was on Broadway about
a big scandal. And George Stevens cast her because she was cleared. She was an actress in Germany at the time Hitler was in power. In order to work as an actress, she had to become a member of the Nazi Party. It's not that she believed in it, but still, I don't know that I would have cast her in the role.
Somebody felt that she was right because they wouldn't have. George Stevens was a sensitive man. I mean, you know, he liberated the some of the concentration camps. He did all the photographs and the film unit. He when he saw that movie, he had made wonderful comedies, you know, before that, and he had a wonderful career. And he saw that he saw the concentration camps, and he was in the war, and he said, "Someday I'm going to do something about this." And that's when he read the diary and met Otto Frank. And Otto Frank,
he's after the war, he said, "I'm never going to make a comedy again." Right. And he never did.
No.
And the film he made after this is very interesting, The Greatest Story Ever Told.
Right.
That
I
was
know.
The next film.
And he had...
No laughs there either.
A Jewish story.
Melly, what was the most difficult scene for you to shoot in this film?
Why, you ask? Well, it was the Hanukkah scene. Did you know that?
No.
Why did you ask that? Do you know something?
No, but isn't that a good question?
Yeah,
I haven't asked that
yeah,
question before.
That's interesting that you should ask. No, it was the Hanukkah scene. That's why Shelley took me to her room and got me drunk, because I was having trouble. I mean, I was not an extrovert. I was not someone who was the life of the party. I was a very determined person that... I think I was a lot like Anne Frank, frankly, as a young girl. I think that's why George saw that in me, and Otto Frank... okayed me, but the Hanukkah scene meant that you had to be on and happy and gay and make everyone feel good, and it was a difficult scene for me, and that's when Joseph Schulkaut, Pepe, we called him, had his speech, and he held my head down so I wouldn't get in the shot while he said his speech, and I knew what all these people were and how they were behaving, and I didn't know if I belonged, but I wanted to be there because of the diary.
Did you ever feel uncomfortable because you were playing a Jewish character and you're not Jewish?
Oh, no. No, I grew up in New Jersey. I mean, well, the Italians and the Jews and the delinquents. My town had the WASPs on one side of the town where everyone wore white bucks and crew cuts. And then there was the middle part of town, Fairlawn Center, and that was where all the Italians, the mafia, and the Jews lived. They had all the money. And I lived in Warren Point, which is where all the delinquents from New York, my father, we had six kids, and the Irish and the weird people, the people that just didn't fit in anywhere. That's
but,
where I lived.
But you had a Jewish boyfriend, Barry,
yeah.
And his mother didn't want him to see you.
That's right.
And then his girlfriend got cast as Anne Frank.
I know, his mother, years later, Barry and I stayed friends all these years and always spoke to each other, and we used to argue. He used to argue about the Jews, and I'd argue about the Catholics, and we would have great conversations, and Barry played the alto saxophone, and his mother took us up to where is that, where all the...
Grossinger's,
yeah. Where all the people went for the Jewish
people. Did
she
apologize to him?
Well, she took me up there, and they were very nice to me to hear Barry playing up there at some hotel. And although I knew in my heart that she brought me up there to let me know I did not belong, because they did not want Barry and I to be together. And so after years later, Barry came to see me when I was visiting my sister in New Jersey, and Barry walked in. I said, "You know, Barry, you're still a jerk," but because we used to talk to each other that way. I said, "And I wanted you to know something. I know your mother planned that night, that weekend up in the Catskills to show me that I did not belong." And he said, "How did you know that? I didn't know you knew that. I knew it, but I didn't know." You know, it was, people were segregated in that way in school. But listen, my father was a sea captain. He was half Hungarian, half Mongolian. My mother was Irish and French, and I never had any prejudices. I didn't have them. And my two most important men in my life were Jewish. So what can I say? I mean, we argued all the time, you know.
Another question
from
the audience?
I'm very moved by the film this tonight. To do with this election that we've all been through and all the nastiness that's been going on and the craziness, it makes me, it's, I don't know, but this film had a different effect on me tonight. I saw things. It's like when Anne Frank says, I still believe that people are really good at heart. I hope that's true, but I never said that before. I always accepted it as a good thing to say. But I hope that people are still good at heart, because we're at a time, as far as I'm concerned, we better start expressing, I don't know, love to each other, because it's not going to be easy, I don't think, the world, what's going on. And seeing the Jewish people coming down the street with the Germans, the Nazis, not the Germans, the Nazis with following them and, you know, taking them away, it makes me think of the refugees. I'm thinking different things seeing this movie tonight that I never thought before.
It becomes timely again in a way. It becomes a sort of timely film in a different way again.
Yeah. And when I did the movie, I got married, I had children, I lived. The Diary of Anne Frank was not prominent in my mind, and about 10 years ago, all of a sudden, everyone's been calling and asking me to come all over the world to show for showings of the diary. All of a sudden, people are caring about that movie. They didn't before. They did, but they forgot about it, but not anymore.
We showed it in Israel at all the three cinematheques. Very memorable, wasn't it?
Yeah, in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and Haifa. It was fantastic.
This gentleman had a question.
We have one back there first.
Okay.
Who? You.
Hi, Millie. My name is Kara, and I was wondering, what is your best, like, industry advice for young actors who are hoping to pursue an entertainment career?
Well, two things. One is you've got to get to know who you are and learn how to express who you are and not be other people and follow what other people are. Find out who you are. The other thing is go to acting classes and join theater groups. You have to do it over. I have a granddaughter here who's raised. Stand up, Sylvia. She's a wonderful actress. She's studying, and she belongs to a theater group. She's played so many characters: men, old men, women, mothers, boyfriends, girlfriends. And that's what you do. You study. After I did the diary, I mean, I had never studied, but after I did the diary, I got into an acting class in California, and that was what I did. I mean, I started studying. I eventually went back to New York and lived in New York and started doing plays and things. But the thing is that you have to learn how to do it. But you have to remember who you are and not try to be other people.
But isn't it amazing what Millie just said? She gave that performance without ever having had an acting lesson.
I know.
George Stevens saw the performance in you. He knew it was in you.
He had to know. He was too smart a man.
He knew it was in you.
And he had ulcers. Poor man. He died of his ulcers. Yeah. But he was wonderful.
But he was a wonderful man, wasn't he? Deeply sensitive.
He had a heart, and he respect. I can't tell you. I was lucky. I mean, as I say, he knew how to treat each actor how to be. I'm just looking at you thinking about what you asked me. Was that answer helpful to you at all? What I said, you know, I've always known that I couldn't be anybody but me, and I would go in. I'm in California, and I see people, actors, all trying to look like each other and be like each other. And you have to find out who you are, because we each have something inside us that's not like anybody else. Anyway, what?
But just end. Millie not only played Anne Frank, she played the Virgin Mary. Elvis Presley's girlfriend and Elvis Presley's mother, among other parts.
I played his girlfriend with Elvis, against him, you know, with him. And then they did a series in 1994, called Elvis the Early Years, and I played the mother in it. And Gladys Presley got a raw deal, because she was not what people wanted to think that she was. They always, everyone else that played her as a drunk and an incestuous mother kind of thing, and you know, pushing her son to be a star. Gladys Presley was not like that. It was the father that was like that. Gladys, when I did the film, I'm sorry, I'm talking about Elvis Presley, but
I asked you.
But when I did the series, and we shot it in Memphis, and two old I'm 80 now, but two old ladies called me up and said, "Hello, I'm Willie and my girlfriend Billy, and we knew Gladys Presley. She was our best friend. And can we take you to lunch?" They took me to a pizza place many times because I became friends with them. And one day we were driving past the insane asylum. On the way from Memphis to Arkansas, and she said, "You see that insane asylum over there?" She said, "I was driving by there with Gladys, and she said, if my son Elvis signs that contract with that Mr. Colonel," she said, "I'm going to end up in that place drunk. And Elvis is going to be dead before he's 40 because he shouldn't sign that contract." And that's, you know, Gladys was special. But, you know, she started to drink, apparently, because she couldn't stand what was going on with her son.
And we'll end with, what was it like playing the Virgin Mary?
It was nice. It was great. We did it. We did it in Tunisia. Arafat soldiers were in Tunisia at the time. There were 5,000 soldiers. It was at a time when no other country, Arafat had 5,000 soldiers. And he needed a place to go with 5,000 soldiers, and the only country that would take him was Tunisia at that time, and I forget what year that was. I played the Virgin Mary. I made friends with my Tunisian driver, and I was the only one that he liked because all the others were English and Italian actresses, and we were on the coast in Tunisia, and they all would bathe topless, and I was the only one that didn't do that, and he thought I was the only nice person there, but then he took me to town and to buy a rug, and they all spit at me, the old men. But the thing is that when I got off the plane, there was bombings, and the Hilton Hotel was on fire, and I said, what is that? And he was a lovely man, Hamidi, and he said, much unrest, much unrest. Bourguiba, who was president at the time, had raised the price of bread, and it was the first time in 100 years that the price of bread was raised, and the Arafat soldiers were killing and riding around in tanks, and we were on curfew. We couldn't leave the hotel before 7 in the morning and had to be home by 7 at night. But what I'm trying to say is that Arafat soldiers held me at gunpoint at the airport when I was going to leave in the middle of the night. I was one of the first people to leave, and the Hamidi drove me to the airport and bought me some coffee, and we sat there, and it was time to get on the airport, and he said, "Oh, time to go, Mili." And each at each gate, there were no Americans there, but at each gate was a soldier, and with a rifle or whatever they carry, those big, long things. And so he didn't speak English, but he's letting everyone go on, which were mostly Tunisians. And he looked at me, and he looked at, "No!" And he started screaming, and he held the gun on me, and he said that I couldn't get on the plane. And my Hamidi, who was a lovely Tunisian man, went pale, and he said, I get you help, Millie. And he ran around the airport trying to get me to get on the plane. And the soldier... I thought like a jerk. I walked up to him thinking, well, I'll speak like a really nice New Jersey mother, and he'll understand. I said, "Excuse me." I said, "But I..." And he shoved the gun in my chest and started screaming at me, and I knew that I was no sense what I was doing. And Hamidi came back, and I said, "Hamidi, take me back to the movie set." It was still like 6 in the morning. He said, "No, Millie, they take you away. We may never see you again. You're in much danger, much danger." Well, that was the scariest thing that ever really did happen to me. And so the soldier at another gate said to my soldier, he went like this, he said, "To come here." And so he started letting all these people go, "Okay, okay, okay." And Hamidi pushed me in the middle of all those people, said, "Mila, you go now." I said, "No, Hamidi." I said, he'll shoot me. He said, "No, go." So we walked. And I walked with those people because my soldier didn't see me leaving because he was talking to the other one. And I'm walking, I turn the corner, and there's more soldiers. And they stopped me because they know I was an American woman. And so they stopped me, and they put me in a room with a woman soldier. And she frisked me everywhere. And then I said to her, I said, "You know, this is silly." And she slapped me in the face. And it was like a horrible experience. And I thought, I will never go to one of these countries again because I'm an American and I'm a woman at that time. Maybe it's going to be that way forever. I don't know. But the thing is that She let me come out and says, it's okay. I walked across the tarmac all by myself thinking, I'm going to be shot now in the back. I get on the plane, and there was one Italian couple there, and I told them what had happened. They said, you must never come to this country again, you know, because it's very dangerous. They could take you away, it's very bad. You must not come. They don't like you. And I felt that was true, and I'm sorry if there's someone here that doesn't agree with me, but it was an enlightening experience, and I won't take those chances. And the things that are going on today.
You were saved, and we're here tonight. And okay. Millie Perkins, hasn't she been wonderful to spend this time with her?
Listen, I talk about myself, and I go on forever. But tell me something. Is there anything about the diary or what you felt? Did you feel about the movie? About, I don't know. Is there anything you want to tell me? Because I felt confused tonight for some reason. It was a different movie to me tonight. I don't know. Maybe I'm very affected by what's going on in the world. I don't know.
Yeah, I think the muscle registry idea and rounding up legal immigrants to be important. I mean, it could happen again.
Well, it was when I saw them marching down the streets in Amsterdam, I thought, oh, my God. It's like the refugees. We have to be loving because we got a president this way and the non-president that way, and there's no solving the hatred and the anger. We just have to be as nice to people as we can possibly be and hope it spreads.
Thank you for listening to Film Forum's podcast. Visit us online at filmforum.org, where you can learn more about our films, memberships, subscribe to our free weekly e-newsletter, and to find out the ways you can support our nonprofit cinema. And if you have the time, please visit our iTunes page and leave a rating and review of our podcasts. Copyright to this program belongs to The Moving Image Incorporated.